This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Maureen Dowd, writes an op-ed column about Washington for the New York Times. It's widely read, usually satirical, and often controversial. Dowd became a columnist for the New York Times in 1995 after reporting on the White House during the Reagan, Bush, and Clinton administrations. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her columns on the Clinton impeachment. With the same skepticism and humor with which she examines Washington, she looks at relationships between the sexes in her new book, Are Men Necessary When Sexes Collide? It considers how the women's movement and the sexual revolution didn't turn out as she expected. For instance, the number of women who want to be on the cover of Maxim leads Dowd to wonder if women have gone from fighting objectification to seeking it. She speculates that feminism has been defeated by narcissism. Maureen Dowd, welcome back to Fresh Air. You write, I assume that one of the positive results of the feminist movement would be a more flexible and capacious notion of female beauty, a release from the tyranny of the girdled, primped ideal of the 50s. I was wrong. Now the ideal of feminine beauty is more rigid and unnatural than ever. Are you referring there to plastic surgery and stiletto shoes?
Yeah, I mean, women used to demand equality. Now they just demand Botox. If you want to see something really scary, just go into the shoe department of Bergdorf's and watch the women get off the elevator. You know, many of them have one face, one body. It's only, I don't mind self-improvement. Anything a woman wants to do to improve herself is fine. What I don't like is self-effacement. And, you know, this where we're headed toward unnatural selection, where you don't no longer look like your mother or daughter or you all just look like each other, sort of these. In Cosmo magazine, for instance, recently did a story called Are We Heading Toward Being a Nation of Plastic Dolls? Now, you know you're in trouble when Cosmo thinks it's gone too far.
You know, some people have the attitude, well, now that we're liberated, we can just celebrate beauty and go back to caring about, you know, being attractive because it's no longer a sign of female imprisonment or second-class citizenship. Do you buy that?
Oh, of course. I mean, at the beginning, that's what I didn't like. I wanted, you know, to be able to wear nice clothes and look for cute guys without the sisters in turtlenecks and Birkenstocks frowning at me. I always liked high heels. I've covered 6 presidential campaigns in high heels. But what I object to is the conformity at either end. I mean, in those days, the women all looked alike and thought alike, and now they're all looking alike and thinking alike. They're all trying to have the same face, the big eyes, small nose, big mouth face, the same hourglass shapes. And, you know, it's not like in the days of Ava Gardner and Audrey Hepburn where you could have all different body shapes and they would be gorgeous. And I don't know. I just, the conformity of it all gets to me.
Well, who can we blame for this? what's going on?
That's a good question. I don't really blame anyone in the book. I just comment on the weirdness of it. Mm-hmm. There are things I miss about the original feminist movement, which is the seriousness of it. I worry sometimes that women, you know, are so obsessed with their next Botox treatment that they're not paying attention to the fact that the Supreme Court is about to swing into an era, you know, that could be very detrimental to women's rights.
If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd. Her new book is called Are Men Necessary When Sexes Collide? Do you think that newspaper pages have been changed in any way by the presence of women reporters and columnists and editors, like your paper, The Times? Do you feel that the things you can point to in the paper and say, the tone has changed, the style has changed, something has changed because there's more women writing or editing?
Well, I think that in my case, I tended to focus more on the person, not necessarily the personal or, you know, but just the person of the president. And up until that time, I think that a lot of the boys on the bus had focused on the, you know, horse race aspect of it, which didn't interest me quite as much. I was always more interested in, you know, let's find out who this person is that will have life and death decisions and whether what he's saying seems to be really what he's going to do. Because politicians often make campaign promises and then do the opposite. Bush Sr. said, you know, no new taxes and then raised taxes. Bush Jr. said, no nation building, and now we're into nation creating in Iraq.
Now, you recently wrote a column on your colleague at the New York Times, Judy Miller, and Judy Miller is, of course, the New York Times reporter who had been covering weapons of mass destruction before the invasion of Iraq. And when asked by the special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, to testify, she chose jail instead until finally deciding she would talk. So anyways, you wrote a column on her recently that started like this. I've always liked Judy Miller. The traits she has that drive many reporters at the Times crazy, her tropism toward powerful men, her frantic intensity, and her peculiar mixture of hard work and hauteur have never bothered me. I enjoy operatic types. Why did you decide to start the column that way, in a really kind of personal way, and bring up what you describe as her tropism toward powerful men?
Well, Judy is a very controversial figure at the Times, and I never had any problem with her, but a lot of people at the Times do, and the place has been in turmoil about it. The Times had written this between her first-person piece and the front page piece about her. The Times had just written 11,000 words in which she admitted that she got it completely wrong on WMD, but said, I'm only as good as my sources. And I just felt, since I'd been writing about WMD and Chalabi, and I had the first interview at the Times with Joe Wilson about Valerie Plame, I'd been writing about these issues for 5 years, and Judy was often a phantom character in my columns, the ones published in Bushworld, because I was describing how an echo chamber was being set up where one or two sources provided by Ahmed Chalabi, Iraqi defectors, seemed like multiple sources because they were going through the administration, and Chalabi was, you know, leaking to journalists. So the journalists and the administration might have the same source, but it would sound like more. And the administration would be able to use stories that had been in the Times to bolster their case to go to war. So I just felt, for the credibility of my column with my readers, I needed to address it. And also, I criticize institutions I care about, like the White House, for a living. So I have to be able to criticize an institution I love, like the Times, if it's in this kind of public turmoil.
But, you know, in the part that I read, you write that the traits that you're pointing out about her never bothered you. So why did you bring them up in the first place? It's kind of...
Because she has been a controversial figure in the New York Times for the whole 20 years I've been there. And these are some of the reasons people,
I see,
you know, don't like her. But those are not my reasons. I like her. I just think that some of the stuff she did was, and some of the stuff in her own piece that she wrote needed to be addressed.
Now, you've said that one of the really difficult parts about being a columnist is that, you know, you want to be liked. You don't want to be disliked. But when you're writing a column, you're often writing negative columns. And, you know, you're not going to be liked by the person you're writing about for writing that column.
I know.
Did this column cause you any particular, like, personal anxiety, because, you know, some people, I'm sure, really applauded you for the column, and other people, I'm sure, were appalled. Was it a tough one for you personally?
Oh, yeah. Everyone is a tough one for me, because I'm not naturally suited to this kind of work. But this one, I hesitated because I didn't want to be in WMD catfight. And I write about catfights in this book, and I say, you know, I thought that was another thing. I thought after feminism that we wouldn't have catfights. But now I realize that we're never going to get rid of them because they're economically profitable. They sell a lot of newspapers and magazines and shows like Desperate Housewives. So I've kind of given up that we're ever going to get rid of catfights. So I knew that that would be the reaction if I did it. And But I just felt that the reasons I needed to do it were stronger than my fear of going through that. Although I'll have to say, you know, the thing that happens that really is very painful is to write something on substance. If you write about the substance of WMD, you know, fake evidence of the war, or the substance of the problem with Judy and WMD, and then your critics go straight to criticizing your love life. You know, it's like you're writing about WMD and they go, well, she dated so-and-so. So that to me is something that they tend to only do with a woman. I didn't see them doing that with David Brooks. So that's just another painful thing you have to expect. But I'm a big girl and, you know, I never get used to it, but because of the illogical nature of it. But there it is.
Did you see Saturday Night Live a couple of weeks ago?
I heard about it. It was like
a news quiz, and they had quotes from your column about Judy Miller and quotes from, I think it was, Paris Hilton. And you were supposed to decide which was from Paris Hilton and which was from your column. And this little game show was called Bitch Fight News Quiz.
I know. Well, that's what I was scared of, and it happened. But my reasons for doing it stayed the same. And, you know, I love Tina Fey. She's very funny. So catfights sell.
So now that you've made it to Saturday Night Live level of notoriety, is that in some ways a very good thing because it means more people know who you are?
Oh, I don't know. You know, didn't Norman Mailer have some quote about writers should always be irritating someone? No, stuff like that just makes me want to crawl under the bed and never get out, and also reevaluate how long I can do a column. You know, I'd much rather go into some quiet form of writing.
Now, another column I want to ask you about is a column that you wrote after President Bush selected Harriet Myers to be his nominee for the Supreme Court. And you wrote about the strong women in President Bush's life and called them office wives. And these are people like Harriet Myers, Condoleezza Rice, Karen Hughes, his wife Laura Bush. And you wrote, W loves being surrounded by tough women who steadfastly devote their entire lives to doting on him, like the Vestal Virgins guarding the sacred fire, serving as custodians for his values and watchdogs for his reputation. What made you start to think of them as the president's office wives?
Well, I thought it was hilarious that President Bush is so insulated and so infantilized that he, by his staff, that he actually mistook someone fawning on him for someone who would have the qualifications for the Supreme Court. I mean, that was an astonishing moment. In my book, I write about, you know, the National Journal had a study where they saw that in the Bush White House, you were five times more likely to be single than your male counterparts. I think 7% of the men are single and 33% of the women. And so Bush has, you know, Condi, who was with him constantly, and that's the way she succeeded in you know, moving up to Secretary of State. And I didn't, you know, if she had a family, that would have been very hard to do. And same with Harriet Myers. And they are this cordon of strong, sort of nanny-like women who just take care of all the president's needs. Condi was his foreign affairs coach during the first campaign. And Harriet Myers took care of all his personal legal needs. And it's funny because the Bush White House for the first term was so hyper-aggressively masculine and militaristic going into two wars. And now Bush just seems to be kind of wandering with this, you know, team of nannies.
What do you find most interesting or perhaps contradictory, perplexing about the president and women in terms of his political policy views on women and the women who surround him in life?
Well, it's interesting because Laura actually was quoted as saying that he liked having strong women around him because of his mom. But on the other hand, other people seem to think that his mom, you know, who has a very tart tongue and was not always doting on him the way these women dote on him, that that's why he likes having them, because they're the kind of giving him the doting he wasn't getting from the tart tongue bar. I'm not sure which of those is true. He does, you know, love being surrounded by these women like Karen Hughes and Condi, who devote their lives to him. But at the same time, you know, a lot of his policies on women are not very progressive.
Like?
Oh, just, you know, I mean, he's trying to appoint a Supreme Court that will roll back abortion rights.
You describe the president as having a feminist foreign policy, but not a feminist domestic policy.
Right. Well, that is another one of the ironic opposite things that has happened with this president, where he sets out to do one thing and somehow manages to clumsily make the opposite occur. He, you know, and Laura both used feminist speeches about how we had to support women's rights in Afghanistan and Iraq as a justification to go to war in those countries. But unfortunately, it's turning out the opposite. We seem to be creating an Islamic state where women will have fewer rights under law and be under burqas. So,
one of the issues you touch on in your new book, Are Men Necessary? Is this: when women become really powerful and win awards in their profession, does that intimidate men? Is that your experience, that that intimidates men? And does it intimidate the kind of man that you'd be interested in the first place?
No, not at all. I think I used an example in the Times excerpt that I think led people to believe I was whining about my personal life, or saying that strong women are, going to be penalized. They may be, but I wasn't saying that it's anything they can't get beyond. They may have to look a little harder or choose different men. But I use the example of this Broadway producer who came up to me at a Broadway opening and said, I thought about asking you out between marriages, but then I decided that, you know, you criticize men for a living, and maybe you'd be critical of everything, you know, every aspect of a man, in other words. And also, I just decided I wanted someone who was more awed by me. But I wouldn't be interested in him anyway, because if he wanted someone who was totally awed by him, that would just be silly. I mean, after you get to know someone, they're never going to be as awed by you. And I just, you know, there's a Woody Allen interview in Vanity Fair this week, and he talks about how great it works with Sunyi, because there's no equality in the relationship, and it's a paternalistic relationship, and there's no conflict, and that made it so much easier just to have her revolving around him and the kids. And there's another interview with Sarah Silverman in Radar, you know, this week, that says when she was at comedian clubs, at being a stand-up comic, that the comedians would want to date the waitresses because the waitresses would be more in awe of them, and she would want to date the comedians because they had a shared passion. So I do think there's a bit of a trend in the culture toward men, you know, wanting to date women who are either in staff support or in some way could revolve around them or be in awe of them. But I also don't think, you know, this is necessarily bad for strong women. They've just got to look for, you know, those guys who want to snap and crackle of a relationship between equals.
This is your second book, your new book, Are Men Necessary? And it's a more personal book than your first book, Bush World, which was a collection of your columns. Because, you know, it's not an incredibly personal book, but you write a little bit more about yourself and you muse more about personal things like relationships. So what does this mean in terms of your life, of, you know, writing in a more personal way?
Yeah, it isn't a memoir or anything. I just thread in a few personal things. I mean, I think a lot of people assume, because I wrote a little about myself, that they can ask about my personal life, or they'll say, you know, well, how can you be writing about men unless you have one? And, you know, that's painful. And in fact, some of my girlfriends warned me not to do the book for that reason. But again, I've covered these issues for 30 years, and I really thought it would be fun to have a breezy kind of look at male, female, you know, how they play, how they work in movies and politics, that could start a national conversation. And I've been really thrilled to get, you know, a ton of emails and calls from especially guys and women, but guys seem to really want to talk about this stuff too in really fun ways.
Well, Maureen Dowd, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Maureen Dowd writes an op-ed column about Washington for the New York Times. Her new book is called Are Men Necessary When Sexes Collide? You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org.